Hey everyone, and welcome to the Bullet Leather Audio Hour. This is Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the End, and I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And I'm still writing my analysis, texts, and everything else that I can get my hands on for our Patreon at patreon.com/bulletleatheraudiohour. And today is the start of a new series that we're doing here on the podcast, because for personal reasons, Sean has to take some time off, and so I'm going to host this podcast here with equally illustrious co-hosts. And my first co-host of today more or less needs no introduction, but he will give you one nonetheless, and it is...
Hi everyone, my name is Emmett Booth, better known within the fandom and online as Poor Quentin. You may know my stuff from poorquentin.tumblr.com, from my ramblings about A Song of Ice and Fire on Twitter, at Poor Quentin. I do a podcast called the Not a Cast that's going through the A Song of Ice and Fire one chapter at a time, which I host with Jeff Hartline, aka Brendan Beefish, another luminary within the fandom. And I'm a big fan of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour and both your guys' individual work. Sean's TV writing, your stuff at Tower of the Hand and the Nerdstream era. Great stuff, so I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. That goes right into me, you know, like oil. Always nice to hear. So, the topic of today that we talked about, what we could do, is basically to get a kind of appraisal of the, unfortunately, still latest book in the series, which is A Dance with Dragons. It's been quite some time. Back in 2011, when this book came out, it got some mixed reactions, to say the least. And I guess in the time since then, people's opinions on this book have shifted quite a lot. And I would like to talk to you as a avowed fan of this book. I think you all would agree with me that it's the best of the bunch.
Yep.
About why it is the best of the bunch, you know? And I had this thought in my head recently that... the reaction to A Dance with Dragons has a lot in common with the reaction to the last before last Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi, in as many people didn't like it for the simple reason that it didn't support the expectations that people had in the material that came out. I don't want to go into if The Last Jedi is good or not. We did a podcast on this, and Sean is very much of the opinion that it's not, while I like it, so we let that can of worms stay closed. But the reaction in and of itself of, how do you say, disappointed expectations has been the same for both works. And I think many people have since gotten around to A Dance with Dragons, at least in those parts of the fandom where people are having Tumblrs and podcasts and that kind of stuff. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think, why is that? Why have people begun to see this book as a great book more and more, especially compared with the earlier ones like A Game of Thrones or A Clash of Kings?
I think there are a number of reasons. One is just that these books really benefit from reread. I think all the books in the series so far do. You notice parallels and interesting little details that you may not have seen before. So I think that helps with any of the books in the series, really. And Dance maybe just needed a little more time to sink in. Didn't have the years that those earlier books had. I think also there's just been a lot of, as you say, writing about that book in particular that has sprung up on Tumblr and elsewhere that has led people to give it a second look. I think seeing what HBO did with the middle part of the series, which, you know, we can also not a can of worms to open here necessarily, but I think it led some people to reevaluate both A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons and see that there were a lot of intricacies involved that didn't necessarily translate to the show or translated poorly, so that led people to go back to the books with a fresh eye. But, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with what you say, that these books frustrated expectations and did so deliberately in a way that I think came off to a lot of people as overly confrontational or even mean-spirited, which I think is fair. I think time and distance helps, and I think The Winds of Winter will also help lead people to reevaluate Feast and Dance, because as much as I love those two books, they're my favorites in the series, a lot of what makes them great is setup, and so we need the payoff and wins, I think, to really fully make sense of them.
Yeah, I've said this before. This is like the middle act, you know. The first three books are the first act, and are pretty self-contained. I mean, at the end of A Storm of Swords, you basically have a closed story and a new one is starting. But A Dance with Dragons left us really right in the middle of things after, as you said, the setup. So yes, there is an execution coming. I mean, just the two battles that will be in the Winds of Winter. Which brings me to my first technical question. In Martin's original plans, the two battles would have ended the book that finally became A Dance with Dragons. Do you think the book would have been better with those battles in it?
That's a really difficult question. I think it's a fair complaint that the books feel anticlimactic to a certain extent without those battles. On the other hand, though, like the Battle of Ice specifically, which is the showdown between Stannis' forces and Hastin Frey at the Crofters' village outside Winterfell, like that's not the climax for the plot. The Battle for Winterfell itself is the climax to that plot, and I don't think that was ever in the works for A Dance with Dragons. So there might not have really been a good stopping point for either of these plots, the Slaver's Bay plot or the Winterfell plot, but I love where the Northern plot ended specifically. I love the pink letter and what it leads Jon to do and how that plays into his storyline. I like the mystery of trying to figure out what exactly went down at Winterfell. I'm a big fan of Quentin Martell's story and character, as you can guess by my going by poor Quentin. So I like that his death and his last try as the climax to the Slaver's Bay plot I really like. I think there is a fair case to be made that, like I said, it feels anticlimactic without those battles. That, again, I think is a disappointment that fades with time, though. That's a first-time read that you go, huh, oh, wait, I thought there was going to be some battles you were building up to. I think once you go back and reread, most of the arcs feel complete on their own. I think Jon has a complete arc in Dance. Dany has a complete arc. Quentin obviously has one because he dies. Theon has one. The only major story arc in A Dance with Dragons that feels somewhat incomplete to me is Tyrion. And I think Tyrion definitely could have used the Battle of Fire or some other major event, because as it stands, his story just kind of stops. So I think that's a fair criticism. I don't think it's necessarily as severe a problem as has been made out. What do you think, sir?
Yeah, I would basically agree on all those points. And what I find interesting about many of those character arcs in A Dance with Dragons and in A Feast for Crows is how much discussion there has been about the meaning of those arcs. I can't remember that people discussed in that manner what did Tyrion's arc in A Clash for Kings actually mean. You know, that is more or less obvious. People discussed the details, you know, when did Roose Bolton start with his betrayal, and what is a secret hint for this or that event, and stuff like that, you know. But with Jon and with Dany and with Tyrion, etc., we have ongoing debates now in the seventh year. What is actually the point of those threads? And there is nothing like a consensus. I mean, you can go on the web and you can read analysis and interpretation about John's arc, for example, which tells you that John is either an oathbreaker, or that he is a betrayed hero, or that he simply makes mistakes, or that he is an idealist that gets his comeuppance when he goes against reality, etc., etc. And you can make decent arguments for all of these interpretations. And some of them can even be combined into bigger pictures, you know, which gives you even more potential readings. And this is one of the things that I find make the foundation of why those two books are superior to the first three, simply on a literary level. And this question of what it's all about. You mentioned Tyrion, and earlier on Twitter, like a few days ago, you said that maybe we overcorrected in the direction of how we view Tyrion's arc. Because when the book came out, people were most disappointed in Tyrion's arc, because on the surface of things, nothing happens, really. He's just doing this road trip through Essos, and in the end, as you just said, his story is kind of over, like kept hanging. And this whole thing about it's all pointless and exposition, etc., pp., that has changed a lot. And people have started to see Tyrion as the biggest villain there is, and this is just one of the many readings of this arc. And you said people have overcorrected. Could you explain a little bit what you mean?
Sure. Well, I completely agree with what you said there, that these storylines engender more debate and more, as you say, more reasonable interpretations on many sides than the earlier arcs. There's so many fascinating debates I've had about the meaning of Jaime's storyline in A Feast for Crows and whether we're supposed to admire what he's doing or not. John and Dance, as you say, is another great example. Dany and Dance. And yeah, and Tyrion, I think people have realized, and this is something I've written about, that the point of Tyrion's storyline in Dance is mostly about tone and character more than it is plot. That it's about kind of adjusting you to Tyrion's mindset and how he looks at the world around him. And it's definitely much more explicitly dark and worrying than in previous books. You can see the seeds for it laying in the first three books, but, you know, Tyrion is definitely a much more unlikable and vicious character in A Dance with Dragons. What I meant by overcorrecting is that I think it's become kind of like the fandom version of like a clickbait hot take where you go, Tyrion Lannister, actually the villain? ? Like, it's become that sort of thing where you lean into it because it's a surprising thing that a character a lot of people liked in the first three books has become so unlikable. And that's definitely true, but I think we may have gone too far in terms of categorizing him as someone we're not supposed to relate to at all. Even in Dance, he's still saving people's lives. He saves Jorah from the horrible fate of the pit fighter. He saves young Griff's life during the Stone Men attack on the Shy Maid. He keeps Penny around when he really doesn't have to. I mean, that goes hand in hand with him being very cruel to Penny and him doing horrible things to a sex worker in the Volantis area. I'm not trying to say that those things didn't happen or that they don't matter, just that I think we've swung from one end of the spectrum to the other, and neither is quite accurate when it comes to defining Tyrion. But I agree, I think there's some real literary value in the fact that there can be such productive and multifaceted debates about what happens to these characters in these two books, and that for me alone disproves the idea that nothing happens in these books. The very fact that such arguments can happen about what these things mean for the characters indicates that quite a lot happens if our views on these characters are so transformed. Feast and Dance don't have quite as many iconic scenes as A Storm of Swords. Like, when you think A Storm of Swords, you think, Red Wedding, Purple Wedding, the zombie attack on the Fist of the First Men, Tyrion killing his father. You know, you have these moments in your head. Feast and Dance are more about, like, the mood and the overall character progression than more than they are individual scenes. So I get being disappointed in that regard. But I think, yeah, just look at how Tyrion used to be talked about before Dance and look at how he's talked about now. So clearly something happened.
I think what you just mentioned, the scene with the sex worker, this is more or less the same thing as in A Game of Thrones when Catelyn said, it should have been you. You know, it's the
right
one moment where the character is at his or her lowest that has been taken as a kind of representative of the character in total, which is, as you just said, a misreading. I guess that's the same thing going on there.
I think that's...
That be correct?
Yeah, that's a great comparison, and... Yeah, with Tyrion, it's specifically, like, you know, people have made comparisons to a person, like a character like Walter White, who you love to hate and you kind of feel connection to, even though he's an objectively bad person, and I think that's true. More what I was reacting to was the declaration that he's completely Tywin 2.0, that he is exactly like his father, and he, of course, has a lot in common with his father, but there are so many things that Tyrion does that his father would never think of doing. There's so many like little kindnesses and little empathetic moments that just would never happen for Tywin. So for me, like we're supposed to be worried about Tyrion. We're supposed to be pulling back. We're supposed to be kind of aghast and horrified. But that for me, that just gives him a mountain to climb in the final books. That gives him something to come back from. I think the show largely skipped over this dark period in his character, which I think is unfortunate. But I do think the place that they ended up at last season, where Tyrion is like pulling back and kind of horrified by what Dany has done and trying to make it right with Jon's help, I do think that's where he ends up in the books as well. I think it's going to be more effective in the books because he's going to have gone through such a low point before he gets there.
Yeah, absolutely. The show had problems there, to say the least. So that's in regard to Tyrion, and you just mentioned Dany as well. Her arc is also different in the books than in the show, because in the books we have quite a lot of uncertainty in her storyline in Meereen. This is also something that pissed people off, because she is put in place, you know, she's very static, just in a location sort of way, throughout the Dance with Dragons, and she seems to be going in circles, you know, the renewed war against Yankai, the peace, again war with Yankai. All those decisions that do not solve anything, that just keep the same conflict going round and round and round. And I mean, of course, there is a message in there. This is not just The Walking Dead or something like that, where they need to tread water until the real stuff happens or something like that. There is a consistent message there. But this makes her arc, especially if you read it for the first time, really, really ingrating. And then you have this gigantic explosion in the end with Drogon returning, mm-hmm. and Barristan going full Ned Stark mode by being out Game of Thrones.
Yes.
And then this last chapter where Dany is on the Dothraki in and the book just ends like throwing open doors to a complete new mood and setting, which I will think will dominate a lot of the Winds of Winter. You know, there will be much more Daenerys 10 than Daenerys 1 to 9, if you know what I mean.
Well said, sir. Yeah, I completely agree. I really love that last Dany chapter in Dance. It's one of my favorite chapters in the whole series. It's the one time she's alone in the series. Like, there's no handlers, there's no one, no advisors, no mass of people she's trying to please. It's just her, for the first time. And it gets into her physicality. She spends a lot of time trying to keep her body going, and she starts having these crazy visions due to her deprivation. And for me, it works because it is really, it's built up to throughout the whole book that I think it's a fair criticism. And luminary in the fandom, Jim, a.k.a. something like a lawyer over at Wars of a Song of Ice and Fire, has said before one of the reasons he doesn't like Dance is because Dany's enemies, the slavers, are not intimidating. They are generally cast as buffoons, or their smart actions, if they are happening, are completely off stage, so it's, you're not scared of them. You're not intimidated the way you were intimidated by someone like Tywin, for example. And I think that's fair, but for me, the drama in Dany's Dance arc is purely internal. Like, the person we're supposed to be afraid of is Dany, because she's like saying to herself, oh, I'm a monster just like Dario. My dragon's going around eating children. I'm feeling full of rage at this piece I've set up. Like, you know, that's where the stakes are in her arc is what she decides to do. And I think it's maybe her dance arc begins and ends stronger than it is in the middle. Like, as Dany's dance arc begins, it's really suspenseful. Like, people are being killed on the streets. You don't know what's going on. She's setting up like this secret police to deal with it. There's some real momentum. And then it does get bogged down a little bit in the middle, which is like she's doing marriage negotiations, and then the Yonkish army shows up, but they're not really threatening. And then it really picks up at the end, as you say, with that incredible set piece at Dazmak's Pit where Drogon shows up. I was just rereading that the other day. And it works so well because Drogon embodies Dany's frustration and her anger. Throughout that whole chapter, she's thinking, I hate this piece I've made. I hate the people I've made it with. This was not worth it. Her husband, Hisdar, tries to unleash lions on Tyrion and Penny, and Dany's just horrified by that. And, you know, it's the classic waking the dragon moment, to borrow that line that's been used throughout the series, when Drogon shows up and kind of represents her fury and her despair and her frustration. So for me, that's a really perfect arc. And at the end of Dance, she says to herself, Meereen is not my home, it never will be. I regret staying here, and I'm going to embrace my Targaryen heritage, embrace conquest and fire and blood. I think that's, you can see the long, clear lines from the beginning of her dance arc to the end of her dance arc in that regard. But it does get a bit mushy in the middle. I know several people who have had difficulty getting through the middle portions of Dance. When Dany's arc is at its weakest, Jon's arc is at its weakest, Bran and Davos have dropped out of the book. I think, for me, you know, Dance often gets heat for the ending being kind of abrupt. For me, the middle portion of the book is actually the weakest.
Mm. Yeah, I can see that argument, but the whole mood and thematic thing, you know, what is peace, actually?
Yes.
When do you have peace? John is grappling with the same question, and we're going to come to him soon. This thing about Denny, I guess most of our listeners are familiar with Adam Feldman's essays of the Myronese Blot. By now they're like, what, 4 or 5 years old? Mm-hmm. But they really broke new ground. And for those who don't know, that what Denny Stark is trying to tell us is that peace is to go beyond price, you know, that this is right, and that Denny's making peace is the admirable thing, and that compromise is kind of a little bit dirty, and that in the end, when she shatters to peace, it is at least a very ambivalent reaction for us as readers, because this is not an unequivocal good thing, you know? And Stephen Atwell especially has pushed against this, and his argument is that it is more like Reconstruction, and that Denny has made way too many compromises and should have, like, exterminated the slaver caste. And in that argument already you can see how much more complicated all of this is, mm-hmm. and why it can't have fixed set pieces. This reminds me a little bit of Steven Spielberg's movie about Lincoln, where he tried to get exactly that into a movie and then failed because he wanted to end with a rousing speech that actually solved everything.
True.
And that is the same thing here. You cannot have this giant set piece that actually solves that conflict, because that would fly in the face of the whole theme and mood and leitmotif that you build up a whole book. So that can't really work there. And man, there's just so much in this, which is incredible.
Absolutely. And I love Feldman's essays. They definitely brought out a lot of what I love about dance. And even the stuff I disagree with, I think, is really well written and constructed. And yeah, I don't overall entirely agree with his conclusions. I think Martin makes the slavers and their peace a little too unlikable and unacceptable for me to get behind that. The fact that they bring back slavery and have a slave market right outside her walls, and it's suggested that a lot of them are just waiting for the Volantines to show up with their massive fleet, and then they're going to go right back against Danny. But there are, to get back to that line, you said the peace is the pearl beyond price. There are moments in A Dance with Dragons that really make you feel that peace. Like when John lets the wildlings through the wall and he stumbles upon people like just playing with snowballs at Castle Black, like they're just children, he says to himself. It's a wonderful, like, sweet picture of innocence that can really only happen because of peace. So I'm not suggesting that Feldman is wrong in saying that peace is the ultimate goal and should be strived for, but it's not easy, and it comes with a lot of sacrifice. And you can see a counterargument from Davos in Dance, where he goes to White Harbor to say, no, this is not worthwhile, this is not acceptable. Yes, we've undergone horrors in the war. I lost sons of the Blackwater. Your lordship lost a son at the Red Wedding, but that was because the Lannisters stole the throne, and now we're just allowing that to occur and letting that pass, and that's just unacceptable. So I think part of what makes Dance both a great book and a frustrating book for many of people is its refusal to really answer these questions. And it reflects that in how difficult this struggle is for John and Danny. I mean, John spends the entire book telling his fellow officers of the Night's Watch, look, we need to make peace with the wildlings. The others are coming. We need to stand together. Even the worst among the wildlings, or at least are human, we need to stand with them. But hey, John, I guess that doesn't apply to the Boltons, right? Because John's sure eager to go to war against the Boltons at the end of that book. Well, why doesn't his logic apply to Roose and Ramsay? So it's very difficult, and there are no easy answers. And I understand why you would come away from such a story feeling kind of unsatisfied, because that's not satisfying. It's deliberately unsatisfying, but it is unsatisfying.
I think you're also right about the fact that the books more or less give you hints as to which side is right, because as you said, the slavers putting up that slave market right in front of Danny's doors and being such unlikable and unthreatening people, highlighting her inner conflict, tells you a little bit about how serious we are to take the outer conflict that is happening there. You know, the question, what exactly will be the terms with the peace with Yang Kai? It doesn't really matter. The important thing is what Danny comes away with, whereas with John, it is much more important and communicated through the book with much more urgency whether or not the terms of this peace work out. You know, we get a lot of John negotiating with his fellow officers, with Tormund Giants Bane, talking about that he has to include the Weeper and the people of the Mother Mole and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of it really doesn't matter because we never see the Weeper again. Mother Mole is most likely dead. And the struggle about the framework that is established here, as you just said, you know, all people, and then forgetting the Boltons conveniently, that matters a lot more than the exact terms of Dany's peace. And the books are communicating this to us. And I think what you just said about John not including the Boltons, this is the last piece of the puzzle that I have added to my personal interpretation. I've never seen this argument before. You made it like half a year ago, I think, for the first time. And I never even thought of it before, you know, because the Boltons are so obviously evil.
True.
And their whole setting and mood, etc., ties in so well with what we experience through Jaime's point of view in Feast for Crows and also in his chapter in A Dance with Dragons about this this Lannister attitude, you know, like that Roman thing, they make a desert and call it peace.
Right, exactly.
So it seems to be quite easy, not the worthwhile piece, and you could give Davos 100 points and move on. But then again, what does it matter who sits the Iron Throne when the dead come calling, you know?
Right, there is that line. Yep.
Yeah, does it matter or does it not matter? Because to Geo Mormont, obviously it mattered, as you said in one of the tweets or on Tumblr, I can't exactly recall. Yeah, but you said that he doesn't like the fact that Joffrey is on the throne. And obviously he's right, because it does matter who sits the Iron Throne. Stannis on the Iron Throne is a lot better for the apocalypse than Joffrey.
Yeah, I think that's a real interesting contrast. In the quote that everyone remembers is from Jon's ninth and final chapter in A Game of Thrones. That's when Mormont says, when dead men come walking, do you think it matters who sits the Iron Throne? But there's that other line, as you say, from Jon's eighth chapter in A Game of Thrones, where he says, we have the undead stalking the woods, and a boy king is sitting the Iron Throne. He says it with disgust. So there, how do you thread this needle? How do you reckon with this contrast where on the one hand you're saying it doesn't matter because we all should band together and, you know, not care about such fripperies as a gold hat and an iron chair when the apocalypse is happening. On the other hand, when the apocalypse is happening, that's exactly when the quality of your leadership does matter. That's when you really need it to be better than Joffrey and Cersei. So I think you can see Martin struggling with that in A Dance with Dragons as well, where, you know, it's Stannis' duty to just stay at the wall and hold the line, but on the other hand, he needs the North to have any chance of really effectively holding the line. And do we think Ramsay is going to be an effective rallying point for the North once the others show up? I'm going to guess probably not. And yeah, same thing holds in Slaver's Bay. Like, you want peace to... And this is a point Ta-Nehisi Coates has made about the Civil War. You want peace so life can flourish, people can be happy, so they can, you know, plant trees and watch them grow, so they can have children and watch them grow up. But for a lot of people under the peace of slavery, that's also impossible. You also don't get to do that. So is that peace worth preserving when it's a state of life that for a lot of people is just as horrible as it is under war? It's a really difficult question. I think Martin does a good job of showing us the arguments on all the sides. Ultimately, I do come down on Dany needed to be harder earlier in A Storm of Swords and at the beginning of A Dance with Dragons, and that would solve a lot of her problems later. And while I do think that Stannis is right to march against the Boltons and Jon is right to aid him in that regard, I do think he goes too far in sending Mance south and then preparing to march overland to Hardhome. I think those are mistakes. But yeah, these are very complex situations, and it's not... Having good intentions isn't enough, which I think is also a point Martin makes with characters like Jaime and Daenerys over the course of Feast and Dance, that wanting to do the right thing might not be sufficient. It might not give you the answers.
And it might might also not be the person that you want, because many people dislike, many people in the books dislike Stannis on a personal level. You know, they just can't stand the guy.
Of course.
And this is understandable perfectly, because Stannis is no fun to have around, like really not. But he is the best man for the job. You know, this argument about leader quality, it reminds me a lot about the podcast that we did 2 years ago when there were still the primaries going on, you know, when the discussion was Bernie versus Hillary. And back then when we said, like, Bernie's policy proposals are closer to our heart, but Hillary is the more competent politician to actually pull them off. It reminds me a little bit of that argument, outdated as it may seem now.
I get you, though.
Like, Robert is definitely the guy you want to have on the throne when there are relationships to be greased and feasts to be held and all that kind of stuff. But when the shit hits the fan, when there is a crisis happening, you want Stannis.
Yeah, absolutely.
He is the guy that the Romans had in mind when they invented the office of dictator. You know, a guy like him. Personally, absolutely unassailable. Like, stalwart character. No one likes him. He does the job and then he goes to some farm and lives out his days in obscurity. You know, something like that. And this would fit Stannis perfectly.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, when you talk about the debate of Stannis versus Renly and how good Renly looks on paper and how happy he makes everyone, well, the book constantly frames him as a young Robert, and look how Robert turned out. Not exactly great as a king, not exactly reliable. Whereas, yeah, Stannis is the one who held Storm's End under siege, you know, starving with his men, going down to roots and rats, so that might be the guy you want around during the apocalypse. And it's a tough balance, because as you say, Stannis is extremely unlikable on a personal, conversational level, and that's bad for politics. That makes it difficult to rally a coalition around you. But on the other hand, you know, having all you have is likability isn't going to be enough to get the job done either. So when I think about Stannis in A Storm of Swords, as a Sam chapter, when Sam and Maester Aemon and a bunch of high officers go to meet with Stannis and talk about the Night's Watch election and so forth, and there's this one little line when they all kneel before him, and as a King Stannis kept them on their knees for an extraordinarily long time, which is a very Stannis thing to do. That's very petty and very just kind of mean-spirited and shallow. So that's the kind of thing that makes you not like him. On the other hand, that meeting ends when he says to those brothers, "You called and I came, my lords. Now you must live with me or die with me. Best get used to that." Which, yeah, Stannis, for all his faults, is the one who actually showed up to do the job, whereas no one else did. And I think you see that reflected in Dance as well. When he is initially planning to march on the Dreadfort, all his knights are on board with him doing it, but Jon comes into the room and says, "No, that's a terrible idea." And Stannis listens to him, and Stannis is willing to go off and recruit the Mountain Clans and attack Asha instead. And that works out for him. He recruits the clans, they join him, a bunch of more northern like lords and individuals join him, and he leads the march to liberate Winterfell. So I think you can see Martin working through his philosophy of leadership there, which is that likeability is important, and not having likeability will slow you down, but it's not the most important thing, and you should look for stronger qualities than that.
I propose John as a little bit of a counterpoint to that, because John is totally ignoring the likeability aspect, and he's paying dearly for it.
Absolutely.
I mean, John is a cautionary tale in you need to bind your base in. And John really doesn't do that. Dany doesn't either, but for Dany it doesn't matter, because her base is an army of Spartans, basically.
It's a little different, yeah.
Yeah, and she has the power monopoly, but John really hasn't. John, the equivalent of John is a guy in the Midwest with a lot of Second Amendment fanatics, and he's trying to keep them together and always forgetting that they are armed, you know?
True. Yeah, John, as we were saying, it's John, I think, in Dance is a case study in why being right is not enough, because John is correct in his policies.
Absolutely.
In Dance. His priorities are the right ones, but that's not good enough. It's not, you still have to be able to make the argument. You still have to be able to get people on your side. Like, the other day I was rereading the scene where he is arguing with his high officers about Satin, his new squire, who is a former prostitute from Old Town, who is a very likable character. whom, you know, we're rooting for and want to see rise high, and the arguments that Marsh and the others are making against Satin are very bigoted and very short-sighted and very unlikable. But John doesn't make quality arguments in favor of Satin. First, he says, well, you know, Satin's perfectly capable of, you know, saddling my horse and fetching my meals, when he knows very well that the squire to the Lord Commander is a more significant position than that. It's you're being trained for leadership, as Sam told John himself when he was made squire to Lord Commander Mormont. And Bowen Marsh points that out, that no, what you're asking people to do is follow Satin into battle at some point. That's what you're actually asking. And then he says, well, yeah, but they followed worse. We have, you know, rapists and murderers at the wall. And it's again like, John, you're not making the best case here, buddy. Like, Bowen Marsh probably hates those guys too. Like, your case should be, there's nothing wrong with Satin at all. He's a perfectly acceptable individual. He knows what he's doing, and yeah, you should follow him into battle. But he lets his kind of temper get the better of him, and he doesn't make the most quality argument. So I think that's a really clever move on Martin's part, to have John be right and wrong at the same time. And that's difficult. That's a difficult story to tell without having it dissolve into mush. And I get the argument about Dance that, for a lot of people, it felt kind of bloated and shapeless. I think it requires careful reading, which is something Feldman did really well with John and Danny's arcs, is to just take you through every decision. Here's what John and Danny did. Here's what happened. Here's the next decision they made. Here's what happened from that. I think if you focus in on it, the story becomes clear. But it's not as... And this is a point Sean made, I think, in his review of A Feast for Crows, that it's not the same thing as having a wildling army with mammoths show up at the door. It's not exciting in the same way in terms of storytelling. I think it's richer and more rewarding, but it's not as thrilling. It's not as cinematic. Yeah.
And I understand this perfectly. I mean, many people don't want their entertainment to be work. So.
Exactly. Well put. That's fair. That's a thing of personal taste. But for me, I don't know. Like, John's arc isn't boring at all. There were still such great scenes in it. Like the wedding between Alice Karstark and Sigourne of Fenn is just a beautifully written scene with all these colors. And Alice says, "Let him be afraid of me," and it's really sweet. Both these young people are putting their lives on the line, and it perfectly captures exactly what John is trying to create. This peace, this symbiosis.
Absolutely, but I mean. Mad Men is a great series, but it's just not for everyone, you know?
Yep.
Is also something you need to put work into it, and if you don't want that after a stressful day, I totally understand that, you know?
It's not good escapist fiction. Yeah, that's perfect. That's a fair critique. It does not function as escapism, and I understand people... That's what a lot of people want from their fiction, especially genre fiction. And Dance does not reward you. Dance is a very grim, bleak kind of book, as is Feast. So, I get that turning people off.
To change gears completely, one of the things that, besides showing everyone why Quentin has a cool arc, that you can write on your own banners is to take what is like two chapters or three at most in A Dance with Dragons and another four or something like from Feast for Crows, and to construct a complete narrative from filling all those missing pieces that we still have and turning Euron Greyjoy from kind of a cool pirate into one of the most significant figures in the whole story. And I want to stress the point, there is nothing on the surface level in A Dance with Dragons or A Feast for Crows to suggest any of these conclusions. You really have to walk the walk and do the hard reading that you just mentioned. So for people unfamiliar with your theory of Euron Crow's Eye, give us a short version.
Sure. So for me, Euron is the ultimate human villain in the story. Not the ultimate antagonist in the story. That is, of course, the others. But Euron, for me, encapsulates and ramps up the human villainy in the story. He's got this weird sorceress background that is alluded to a couple of times. When he first shows up in A Feast for Crows, he's talking about gods and how he's heard everyone pray to their different gods and it availed them nothing against him. And then, yeah, there are these images. He's not present in A Dance with Dragons. He doesn't personally show up. We don't get any Euron Greyjoy POV chapters, nothing to do with the Iron Islands or the Reach in Dance, which is unfortunate. But there are these images of him seen by other characters. Makuro, the Red Priest, glimpses in the flames, this tall and twisted thing with one black eye and sailing on a sea of blood, chasing Daenerys, which is, I think, clearly intended to be Euron. Dany has a dream of of someone with blue and bruised lips attacking her with a manhood cold as ice, which I think is also Euron and indicates a connection with the others. And I'm far from the first to bring this up, but there's strong evidence indicating that Euron was a protege of Blood Ravens at some point. The symbolism of his banner with the crows anointing an eye, the symbolism of crows and eyes are, of course, strongly connected to Blood Raven, and Euron has that line at a feast for crows about having flying dreams when he was a boy. So I think there are indications, and of course, all this gets ramped up when you get to The Forsaken, the released Aaron Greyjoy chapter from The Winds of Winter that George Martin read at Balticon a couple years ago. So I think there are strong indications that Euron is not just another Greyjoy pirate asshole, but is strongly connected to the magical side of things and the apocalyptic side of things, and that he is, you know, obviously people have pointed out that there, some of the more heroic characters have villainous equivalents. Like, you know, Ramsay is in some ways the villainous version of Jon, a northern bastard who felt left out of his family, but whereas Jon has kind of risen above his resentment, Ramsay has given into it completely and is just a horrifying sadist. And I think you could argue that Euron is the evil version of Bran. If he is indeed a rogue protege of Blood Ravens, then of course they have that link. Euron kind of preyed on his family, whereas Bran has only supported his. Euron mentions at one point that they had a, quote, soft-headed brother named Robin, which sounds like it might have been his version of Hodor. So Euron is a character like Bran who has access to all this kinds of power but has chosen to indulge in it in a hideous apocalyptic way. But yeah, that's not... He hasn't had the payoff for it yet. He's like Tywin pre-Red Wedding. There's only just kind of hints at what he's all about and what he's really accomplished. You haven't seen him go full metal album cover yet, again, until The Forsaken. So, I don't know. I love Euron's character. I love his dialogue. I love the imagery surrounding him. I love the way he's written. But if you're not into that side of the story, or if you're just not expecting that side of the story to exist in the same context as the Ironborn, I could see not being into that yet.
Which is kind of a shame, because I think this story is absolutely great. I think when you read The Feast for Crows, it wasn't entirely clear where the Ironborn plot went and what its purpose was, you know, other than there are more dangers, more stuff that is going on. And of course, The Feast for Crows immensely profited from the fact that A Dance with Dragons is out there now and gives us a much better grasp on what the themes actually are. And this brings me to a question I want to talk about, because Sean, as he reminds us in every intro to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour, is the author of the Combined Reading Order.
Yes.
And you made a point like 2 or 3 years ago, I think, that while the Reading Order is a perfectly good thing in and of itself, it obscures the fact that A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons function as their own books, independently from each other, which is a strange assertion, because obviously they're two halves of the same story, you know, they're incomplete without
True.
Each other. So
True.
Could you, for our listeners, reiterate that argument as well?
To be clear, I think the Combined Order is awesome. I've enjoyed several Combined Orders, including Sean's. It's a great idea because, of course, as you say, the books take place at the same time, and there are a lot of interesting parallels between characters. There are plot points that exist in common. Like Cersei in A Feast for Crows brings up what's going on with the Manderleys and Davos and White Harbor, and of course that plot actually exists in A Dance with Dragons. So I think the Combined Order is great if you don't like Feast and Dance. If you feel that they are incomplete or confusing or all over the place, then I think the Combined Order is for you. But it's not my preferred reading, because Feast especially, I think, is a really interestingly cohesive book in terms of its themes. Like, pretty much all the storylines start out focused on one specific death. You have Balin Greyjoy in the Iron Islands, you have Oberyn in Dorne, you have Tywin in King's Landing, Lysa in the Vale. When Jaime gets back out to the Riverlands, there's a lot of focus on the Red Wedding, and specifically on Robb being dead. And from the title on down, there's this focus on what do you do once the important person is dead? What do you do when the king is dead? When the hand is dead? When the lady of the Eyrie is dead? How do you deal with this? And I think that's really interesting, because a lot of stories would just move forward from Storm without kind of dealing with the impact. It's like the equivalent of like having a slasher movie which of course, you know, a ton of people die in it, and then having the sequel to the slasher movie be all about like their funerals and their families mourning them and trying to figure out what to do next, and having, but not having a slasher in that sequel. Like, that's kind of the equivalent of what Feast is, and I get that putting people off, but I thought it was a great gambit and a way to make those deaths really soak in and feel meaningful is spending so much time dealing with the consequences. And so I like Feast in isolation for that reason. Dance is a little clumsier in terms of its structure. There are, like, there is just the one Jamie chapter in Dance that just kind of comes out of nowhere. There is just the one chapter in Dorne. There is a couple chapters in King's Landing towards the end of the book, all of which are great on their own. They do feel a little out of place in the book that's mostly focused on the North and the East. So there are definitely negative consequences to having them split up. But I like Feast's structure on its own, and I think they're also different books in terms of tone. Feast has this weird, like, sense of black comedy to it, this odd little humor going on with, like, Cersei's chapters, Victarion's chapters. There's a kind of, like, detached, savage, like, isn't it funny that this ridiculous person is a POV kind of humor going on in A Feast for Crows. Dance is not quite that. Dance, in terms of its tone, feels a little more like Storm. It's, like, very big, very epic, very, very kind of sad and scary at certain points. So I think there is, I think I do, when I last read a combined order, I think there is some whiplash going from, like, a John or Dany chapter, where you're supposed to be invested in them and what they're doing, going from that to a Cersei chapter, where the whole point is, ha ha ha, look at this ridiculous person who thinks they're in charge. Isn't it going to be funny when they inevitably get what's coming to them? And then, of course, it's not that funny. You get the comeuppance with the walk. But, yeah, so, I mean, I'm not against the combining orders by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think Feast and Dance work well on their own if you give them a little leeway and if you kind of see what Martin's getting into with them.
So my short take on this, and you agree or disagree, I think the first-time reader should pick up the combined reading order, and if when you're going to reread, you should read them separately.
I like that a lot.
I agree with that.
Yeah, because I understand that when people read Feast for the first time, there's like, what? Where's Jon? Where's Dany and Tyrion? Those are my favorite characters. Where's Davos? Where's Bran? So, yeah, for the first-time reader, go at them in combination so you can get all the characters, see all the parallels. But then, yeah, give Feast and Dance a try on their own. I think you might find them better than their reputation suggests.
Another thing about the general setting and structure that goes in well with what you just said is just a little transgression. I recently watched E.T. With my son for the first time, who is 6 years old.
Oh, really?
And it is still the magical movie that it was back then. But right at the end, I thought, the characters are really lucky that the movie ends where it ends, because there is a shit ton of problems coming for these people who defied the government and let an alien escape. So, and I kind of feel that Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons, they are basically like E.T. 2. They are going for all the stuff that follows from what most authors would basically do as the end of their story. You know, Martin is famously quoted with his you never get to know what Aragorn's policies are when he becomes King of Gondor.
Right.
And there is a lot of shit happening in Feast for Crows and Dance with Dragons that is simply fallout from whatever happened in Clash of Kings, Storm of Swords, Game of Thrones. Jaime's whole arc is basically only fallout. I think in his arc this comes through the strongest, but Brienne, already very concerned with it, part of it bleeds into Storm of Swords with Arya's arc when she is touring the Riverlands and seeing all the carnage. Martin is concerned a lot with the consequences of actions, and I think this is also something that puts people off, not because it's bad or something, but because you don't expect it. Normally you don't have it. Like, there is no E.T. 2 where people are having hearings in government buildings, and there is Attorney General taking Elliot's mother out for aiding and abetting alien invaders or whatever. And this is very much happening in A Feast for Crows. And I think this is also one of the things why it's so misunderstood, because we do not yet have the established vocabulary for dealing with this sort of thing. You know, so few people are doing it that you as the reader or the viewer are not equipped to really handle it, which is, I guess, one of the reasons why this show went over this so quickly, because it requires pages on pages on pages to do this right. I mean, there's a reason why those books are as thick as they are. And you don't have this time in the series. And I think this is one of the major structural reasons why they put it out and then had to scramble and fill other stuff in. Would you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree. It's a difficult story to tell. Of course, as you say, a lot of it is internal. And it's not exactly... It's not vivid or exciting in the same way, but it does, you know, it could... There are plenty of moments in Tyrion's dance arc that I think Peter Dinklage could have killed if he'd given, been given the opportunity to do so. There are a lot of great character moments that you can give to your actors, and I don't know, I think if you're telling a story for long enough with any kind of integrity, you do have to deal with the fallout. I mean, I think about, like, how at some point in modern superhero franchises, they all become about the consequences. Like, you know, the Marvel movies kind of leaned in that direction with Captain America's Civil War, when that movie became about, oh, look at the consequences and the collateral damage from all our previous movies. How do we deal with this? How do we define ourselves going forward, given that we caused this? What do we think of ourselves? That can be done well or poorly, of course. The DC version of that was Batman v Superman, which wasn't especially well received. So that alone doesn't make your story good. You can deal with consequences and fallout in a way that's boring or pedantic or just uninteresting. But for me, what makes Feast and Dance work so well is that it comes at these questions rooted in character. Like, Jaime tells himself at the end of Storm, I'm turning the page. I'm going to write whatever I choose henceforth. This is a new beginning for me. But life doesn't really work like that. Like, he has to go out and deal with the consequences of the decisions his father has made, and he has to own them. You know, when he confronts his cousin Lancel at Derry, and, you know, he asks Lancel, like, you know, how did you get to this position? What made you do what you did? And he says, I wanted to be like you. And so, like, Jaime, like, you know, no matter how much you want to turn the page now, those previous pages still matter. The impact is still there. No matter how much you try to be a good person now, you're still dealing with the fallout of it. And... you know, I think that's a really emotionally honest approach to storytelling. I'm not the biggest fan of Jaime as a character, but I really love his chapters in Feast even more than the ones in Storm, because they really put him to the test and make him face that question. And I think it would have been easy to skip over it, and it would have been easy to do it in a way that seemed divorced from character. But yeah, I think Feast and Dance to me would be a lot less interesting if it was just people wandering through the graveyard, if it wasn't rooted in character, if you had... Brienne's story wouldn't be nearly as good as it is if it didn't climax with her no chance, no choice moment of standing up for these random kids against Rorge and his boys, knowing that she might go down doing it, but deciding that's what she believes in. That's really what makes the book work for me, is the character moments within this context of the fallout from the first three books.
I think it's also important to note that Jaime fails at trying to turn this page. You know, it is not only that it doesn't work, as you said, because people do not forget what you did before, but it is also that Jaime does it wrong. He's trying to take shortcuts and trying to have his cake and eat it too. He would need to really emancipate himself from his family and from his station, but he can't, because he wants to have this. He wants to be Golden Hand, but without the actual work involved. What he would need to do is to repudiate his family completely, and not only in theory, but he all does it half-assed. You know, when he defies his father, he still remains the Lannister in waiting. He could always go back. And when you can always go back, then it is not a real thing, you know? And this is what permeates Jaime's chapters throughout A Feast of Crows. This whole, I am trying to make this peace, and now let's all look forward. But at the same time, he is basically bagging the loot and expecting everyone, now that he has bagged it, to accept a new status quo. And that cannot work. He doesn't give anything up.
Yeah, there's no real sacrifice involved. When I think about, like, No, I admire Jamie for wanting to have a fresh start and wanting to move on and do better. That's great. But for me, what that looks like is Sandor at the Quiet Isle, becoming the gravedigger, giving everything up in his life and devoting himself just to helping others and to doing good and to being in his station. Like, that's what you got to do. And, you know, it's Jamie does walk away in his one dance chapter with Brienne, but it happens so abruptly that there's no real time for mental processing of that event on his part. We don't really see him consider it or think it through. So I hope when we get to the Winds of Winter, if and when we get to the Winds of Winter, that from Jamie's POV we'll see some real reckoning with that. Because yeah, I agree. It's such a difficult position to be in where you want to do good, you're trying to do good, your intentions are best, your individual decisions are good, but the context you're working within is fatally flawed. I think that's something Martin really gets into heavily with Feast and Dance is what does it look like to be the hero when your context doesn't support being the hero? What does it mean for Quentin to go on a brave, shining adventure when he's doing it in a war zone, which is not exactly the environment you want for a brave, shining adventure? What does it mean for John to try to save the world when he still has to work with flawed, bigoted human beings like Bowen Marsh? What does it mean for Dany to try to save people's lives when she's inevitably going to have to cut some kind of deal with horrible people? And underneath all that, you have Tyrion, who's basically telling all of them, look, I tried to be the hero. I told myself I was going to do justice when I got to King's Landing. Look how that worked out for me. One of my favorite shows on television right now is The Good Place on NBC, which I recommend heartily to anyone who has not checked it out. It's a great show that has kind of a light tone to it, but really deals with some intense philosophical questions at the core of which is, what do we owe to each other? How do you be a good person? Which seems like a simple question, but it's really not. And for me, that is the animating question through a lot of A Song of Ice and Fire, but especially in A Dance with Dragons. How do you be the hero? And it's there's no real one answer to that question.
You know, one of the things that is so great about all the structure and the literary levels that's going on about Jamie and giving things up, we have a whole character arc that is basically spilling all of that out, which is Arya.
Yeah.
Because she's told time and time again, if you want to really start over, to really become no one, which is basically turning the page, right? You start off as no one. Then you have to give up everything. And Arya fails at it pretty obviously. And I mean, her arc, you cannot really misunderstand because it carries what it wants to say on its sleeve. But you can read it as a companion piece to Jaime. You really have to give that stuff up. And this is one of the things about these two latest books that I like, how those arcs and themes reinforce each other, even over the orders of the two books themselves, you know?
Yeah. No, I really like Arya's storyline in the context of a Feast and Dance as a whole. I kind of think of her storyline as being at the center of it all. Like, it's like her storyline is where everything is kind of broken down and put in its most blunt form. Like, she's in this building with all the gods in it, all the gods of death. So you have all these other storylines and feasts that are about these individual deaths, but then Arya's storyline is like where it all comes together. And you have the Faceless Men are kind of looking at all this entire world full of death and the fallout from it and trying to get some meaning out of it and trying to break your identity, break your history, your backstory, your place in this context down to its component parts. And like you say, that's an enormous challenge to take on, and it's not one Arya succeeds at. And we're kind of left to question it. Is this what we want for Arya? Like, you know, being a faceless man would certainly allow her to give up grief and this kind of horror that she's had to deal with, but it would also turn her into a robot. And that's, you know, we don't want her to give up Needle was Jon Snow's smile and her memories and love of home, you know, her connection to Winterfell. But on the other hand, one of the things I really love about Arya's storyline back in the Riverlands is how she was shown, hey, guess what? The quote-unquote good guys, your brother's men, the Stark side, they're not great either when it comes to taking care of the small folk. They're killing people just the same way as the Lannisters are, and there's that great moment in Storm where the Brotherhood Without Banners spends the night in an abandoned village, and she's like, why, you know, what happened here? And she gets told, your grandfather did this. Hoster Tullock came down in this village with fire and blood, basically, when the local lord stayed loyal to the Targaryens during Robert's Rebellion. And Gendry gives her this, like, horrified look, and she feels bad. So Is it worth holding on to? Is Arya better off giving up her identity? Is the world, would the world be better off if we all functioned like faceless men? Or is that giving up something really precious? That's something that Dany, a question Dany faces throughout A Dance with Dragons. What is my identity? Who am I really? Am I the peacemaker? Am I a Targaryen? Am I fire and blood? Am I the queen of Meereen? Am I the heir to Westeros? What kind of person do I want to be? And for me, that's, facing that question is maybe more compelling, if less exciting, than just being challenged. Like, Jaime's chapters in Storm are more exciting than his chapters in Feast. Like, he's on the run, they get captured, he gets his hand cut off, he tells, you know, he jumps into the bear pit to save Brienne's life. They're like, there's nothing heart in your throat like that in Jaime's Feast chapters. But the reason I find them more compelling is because he has to try to put into practice what he learned from those earlier events. What did you take away? And yeah, same thing with Arya. I agree there's a parallel there. Arya in Braavos is facing the question, what did I learn from my horrific time in the Riverlands? What did that mean to me? What does that mean for my next step? And that, it gives it more weight. Like, I think I enjoy the first three books more now because of what happened in Feast and Dance. They have more weight to them now, at least for me.
Yeah, I absolutely agree on that. The only character we haven't touched so far is Bran, and I feel that he is the least well-served of A Dance with Dragons because he only has those three chapters, I think, and then he's off.
Yeah.
He just stops.
That's fair. I love those chapters. I think they're incredibly well-written, especially the last one. His chapter in the cave is just, the prose is just, like, beautifully done. And you get the sense of his disorientation and his, the way he's being immersed in all this magical plot is beautiful and terrifying and psychedelic and everything I love. But yeah, like you say, he only has three chapters. Martin, I believe, cut a Bran chapter from Dance. There was going to be four chapters, Bran chapters in Dance originally, and there was going to have one, I think, after Jon's assassination. So that's really intriguing to think about where that story could have gone. But yes, Bran does kind of vanish halfway through A Dance with Dragons. So that is one place I think the criticisms of Dance's structure are perfectly fair. Bran does feel like he just kind of vanishes from the book.
Yeah, I have a soft spot for him. He's always my favorite character.
I remember,
and,
sir, yep.
And I was like, his chapters were the one I was most looking forward to when A Dance with Dragons came out, and then it was like, where has he gone? So,
and his storyline is so intriguing just because he's on the precipice of so much power and information, and it feels like, and I've always felt this way, that Bran is, if not the most prominent character in the story, he's the one at the heart of it. He's the one at the core of things. He's the one, you know, his chapters are going to have the revelations and really drive the overall story forward more than really anybody else. So I could have used more of him. He's probably the one, the POV I'm most looking forward to going forward. Him and Sam, anyway, I think are going to have the most interesting chapters for me. But yeah, I would have loved to see at least a couple more. The same thing happened though with Bran in Storm. He only had like three or four chapters in that book, too, and they were really good chapters. Again, beautifully written, but
They were not crammed into the first third.
Yeah, exactly. They're a little more spread out. That's true.
Okay, I think we kind of covered it all, and our time is also up. So if for some reason you didn't like A Dance with Dragons, I hope we changed your mind. And if you did love it before, I hope your love has been reaffirmed. So thank you, Emmett, for talking to me and co-hosting this episode of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. The Boiled Leather Audio Hour Patreon is still going, so if you want to chime in and support the show and keep it going the way it is, please consider going to patreon.com/boiled. You get access to the exclusive content I write, which I mentioned before. For $2 a month, you get the BLAM, the short question answering podcast I do with Sean, and we have quite a huge backlog of those, so you will get your portion of Sean, even though he's missing for a time from the regular shows. And for $5, you can put in your own question. So consider it. Please go to the Patreon and check it out. Thank you, Emmett, once again. And tell the listeners where your own podcast can be found.
Thank you again for having me on, Stefan. Like I said, I'm a big fan of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour, and I wish Sean good luck in all his pursuits and hope he can get back to it eventually. For my own part, yes, you can find me on Twitter, @PoorQuentin. You can find my blog at poorquentin.tumblr.com. I took a couple months off of that particular page because I was moving and working on the podcast, and just, you know, lots of personal stuff, but I am actually actively taking asks and writing stuff on the Tumblr again, so check that out. Send me an ask if you have any questions about A Song of Ice and Fire you'd like me to answer. And yes, you can also find me on the Nauticast podcast. Nauticast, A-S-O-I-A-F on Twitter. Our Gmail is nauticast@gmail.com. You can check out our Patreon at patreon.com/nauticast, A-S-O-I-A-F. And check out my co-host as well. Like I said, Jeff Hartline, a.k.a. Brendan B. Fish on Twitter. He is a delightful fellow.
Thank you guys for listening, as always, and until next month with my next illustrious co-host, it will be, I can at least tell you this much, it will be Jim, who goes as something like a lawyer, at least when we can make the dates and time zones work, but I really hope this will play out, so there will be an interesting discussion coming with him as well. So, until next time, thank you, bye-bye.